Colonel Pryke, Reel 5.
I'd like to add that, on the whole, they were amazingly honest. Whether this was just part of the makeup or not is difficult to say. I think this honesty was, some of it was due to the fact that if they were caught out, of course, they lost their jobs, and this meant not only their livelihood, but all their families suffered as well. But whatever the reason was, they were remarkably honest, and there were very few cases of theft. Where there were, of course, then they lost their job. But certainly I personally got a very good deal out of them indeed. They looked after me, and I said they were honest. The nurse side, I think they had a certain respect, if one tried to analyze it, for the officers, because they did get probably as straight a deal as they had known. And in my opinion, they're probably a straighter deal than they got from their own people at that time, from what I saw. This wasn't always so with everybody. They got a rough deal, probably, from the soldier, but again, it was probably a fair deal. They got very rough treatment from the soldiers, indeed, but it was given with a certain camaraderie, and if the Indian could respond to it, one did see them get on remarkably well. It was rather like Kipling stuff over again. The soldier would bully, if you like, the Indian bearers, not the bearers, but the Indian servants he came across, those who brought the tea and buns and cakes. But he did it in the sort of the British soldier's friendly way. It's a ragging way. And if the chap responds, then everything was all right. And as a result, these tea wallers used to get everywhere. The chaps would go out in training. You'd literally have 10 minutes halt in the middle of training somewhere in the middle of nowhere, and up would come all these tea chaps with their buns and tea, and they followed the soldiers everywhere. I don't think they'd have done that only just for the few annas they made out of it. I think they did it because in the end it was part of the service they wanted to give, and they had a sneaking liking, although they got bullied by the British soldier.
You said something about your attitudes as an officer in those times towards different sections of the Indian people in the north and in the northwest. What was your attitude towards those sections of the Indian population who have been traditionally regarded as non-martial, like the Bengalis and the Madrasis? Did you have any particular attitude towards them, or did you just treat them as individuals?
I think there was a traditional spirit handed on to me of a dislike for the Babu Wala. We did come across them. They were the ones who looked after your accounts. They were the rather more educated ones who came from the south. One saw it when one passed through Bombay in and out. You saw them in the banks and the shops. You saw them in the local bazaars too, in places like Meerut. They were the ones that made the money. And there was a traditional dislike handed on. And I had, in fact, read a very fine book by a previous general in India who had pointed out his theory that those in the south, in fact, were the finest fighting troops in the world originally, the Bengali and Madrasi, for example. But it was only by our use of them and gradually civilizing the whole of that south that, in fact, they lost their martial qualities. And we gradually recruited an Indian army up north and further north until finally we reached the ultimate, really, which is the Punjab. But there was certainly a traditional distrust of the Babu type, and he wasn't altogether a man that you liked either. The ones who came across were those I said in the account side, and they had a very narrow mind indeed, a rather infuriating one. The rules and regulations had to be applied regardless, and they certainly had a rough ride from some of us, yes.
How much of the local towns did you see outside of the cantonments?
One saw quite a lot of one's nearest town. In my case, I said this was Meerut, and then later on Ferozepur and Lahore. And then one saw quite a lot of the minor towns, probably, when you were out shooting. And I also visited my brother in his Indian Army area, too, where he was, at Campbellpore and around there. And I saw some of the villages of towns, of course, up in Kashmir, places like Srinagar. So one did wander around the bazaars and see everything. And I have to repeat what I said earlier on, one did this with complete confidence. One never ever dreamt that anyone would ever come up and attack you or steal from you. I would like to bring this home. There was a complete sense of confidence about wherever you went, and this could only be because you trusted them to a large degree.
Did you, as an officer in those times, take any interest in Indian arts and crafts, or visit any of the famous architectural sites?
I did in... I went around the fort and everything else. I wouldn't call it whether that was art or not in Delhi. The only art we really saw were the people who brought things round to you in the bungalow in your quarters. And this is mostly based on Benares brassware and other gimmickry, which wasn't very artistic. Carpets, which weren't Indian, but came into India, of course, from over the northwest frontier area. And one never really saw much of true Indian art. You couldn't go into their temples or mosques, really. I think one had been very unwelcome, and we were not encouraged to do so. So there was no real art in any of the towns that one saw, and certainly the ones I was at, except possibly Delhi.
Did you bring any curios or anything of that kind home from India?
Very few indeed. I think I'd been put off by seeing some of the retired officers' houses back in England where it was full of brassware and everything. I brought back one or two things I liked only. It was a cigarette box and a bowl in brassware. It was rather artistically and nice, I thought, but otherwise nothing, no. Apart from a rug I bought off a camel coming over the pass in the northwest frontier of India at Rasmuk, and that's been with me until now. It was now declared an antique and worth a lot of money. I think I paid £5 for it at the time.
Did your feelings towards Indians vary according to whether they were townsmen or countrymen?
It's a very fair question. I think on the whole there's very much a prejudice amongst ourselves for the country peasant. The Indian Army types that you met were usually very fine. I had great respect for the Indian Army soldier and the NCOs and subedars. And they were all country people, I think almost to a man. They've been zemindars, small landowners in the country, and they were people that a Britisher, a European, could understand much more easily. Her philosophy of life and their religion was mostly Punjabi, was mostly Muslim. They were straight, as only a country person can be, and you could understand them. The city man was much more difficult, and you only saw probably the worst side of him in the teeming bazaars, where he was living in very crowded conditions, and crowded conditions don't bring out the best in people, and in poverty. You saw this poverty, and one felt very compassionate, but there's nothing you could do about it. It was dreadful poverty.
You've spoken of of the general preference of officers for Muslims rather than Hindus in certain senses, or of the Muslim religion as being able to understand the Muslim religion as compared to the Hindu religion. But did you and the other officers ever feel that there was much more danger from the Muslims because of their religion?
No, I didn't think we ever felt that. I didn't think we ever felt any real danger, except, as I said earlier on, perhaps when they were fighting one another, there was very little anti-British hostility shown, and what there was by Congress was very passive anyway. And I certainly don't remember anything like that, except on the northwest frontier where they were fighting us completely as wazirs and masuds. I would like to correct the word I used earlier on, the thing I said a moment. I was talking about the masud. The wazirs and masuds were the two tribes up there, and of course they were shooting us to get us out of the country.
Was the relationship between officers and men in the army in India different in any way to that between officers and men in England? Did the fact that you were soldiering in India create any different kind of relationship between the officers and men?
Yes, I'd say very much closer. This is universal. It wasn't just in India, but wherever you have soldiers and officers or you have the regiment, the army serving abroad, you are both going through experiences, some of them very tough. And so you share the same dangers, you share the same experiences. And therefore, you have to know your men very closely. There's a much greater understanding between you because you're sharing some pretty nasty experiences. And some good ones too, of course.
Did you have any specific problems of man management in India because of the conditions under which you were soldiering? For example, of the question of boredom or the mental health of the troops. Was this a particular problem which loomed large for you in India?
No, I saw no mental problems at all, like one sees nowadays. I think psychiatric wards were unknown. The men liked to be left on their own off duty. After all, they were being worked hard. When I work, I include sport. So if a man wasn't working, he was playing sport, and was being supervised and being worked or played so hard every day that he wanted his time off to relax. And I think we respected that. And the time when you really experienced a closeness with the men in off-duty periods was, of course, playing sport. But apart from that, was when you were orderly officer, and as a young officer out there, this came on rather too frequently almost, and you did things like closing down the naffy bar, the beer bar, last thing at night. And you got a lot of men who have all been relaxing, having a lot of beer, and you taste their food, and you taste the beer. It was traditional to say it was all right. And then you stayed there for a drink or two, and then you finally ordered the place closed. This was the time when, if you were, they tried out on you to see whether you knew how to handle the situation. There'd be a few ragging remarks, which you didn't handle them rightly. Well, all right, they'd make a few more remarks that were a bit more so, rather like handling schoolboys in a form. They're trying it out on you. That was the time when you had to show your man management and get the respect of the soldier. But normally, this was. You were tried out in sport as much as anything else, and in soccer and hockey, boxing, everything else. I think the soldiers are watching you. You came out absolutely fresh. Many of the soldiers, when after all, when you're going out there for 6 years on a tour, some of the soldiers have been out there before, or have been there some time, and they were watching this young new man come along, who's wet behind the ears and had white knees. And they tested you out. So the trouble with man management here was to show that you could accept advice. Yes, your sergeant was there to try and look after you and see that you got a fair start, but you couldn't rely on him too much. After a while, you had to stand on your own feet, and that was very good training. And I think it was a fair test you went through with the men. You had to earn their respect in every way. Once you'd done that and found your feet and proved yourself, then I think relations were very good indeed. And they were much closer, as I said, than serving back in England.
In the officers' mess in India, in your particular regiment, was there a great deal of formality and tradition?
Not more so than other regiments. In some ways, we were more informal, and in the hot weather in Meerut, for example, we actually initiated, instead of wearing the mess kit, we wore no jacket, a silk shirt, and a bow tie, and a black and a cummerbund, and trousers. And I think we were one of the first regiments, the British regiments, to do without a jacket, which is quite revolutionary in those days. We were no more formal than probably back in England, by any means. You had the usual dinner Monday, Tuesday, Thursday, Friday, and you had the regimental silver out, and the band played. This is quite normal throughout the British Army. I think as a regiment we were probably rather over-formal at the beginning, and with young officers who really got really put in a corner. You don't speak unless you're spoken to, and they got bullied by the senior subaltern, so you got pretty good head as a young second lieutenant. But this again was treatment in many regiments that everybody got and had to go through initially. But the formality was certainly a major, as you call sir, and the colonel was either sir or colonel.
Was the mess run on democratic lines?
I would say on the whole, no. there were mess meetings, and the president of the mess committee, the PMC, ran that. But very much the senior officers had their say, and you had to be a very brave young officer to speak up.
What arrangements were made for leave?
I can't remember the exact time. I think one got very nearly as much as 2 months a year, or certainly 6 weeks. And you could certainly, I think, get 2 months. I'm disregarding the frontier at this stage, because you saved up some leave. I might be wrong, it may only have been 6 weeks, but the main thing was that certain sports like shooting and pig-sticking were favoured as being good for your training, I think. This is the general attitude above. And so, apart from weekends, If you added on a few days to do some shooting, this all was supposed to come out of your 6 weeks, but in fact, you really could get an enormous amount of leave. What you couldn't get was leave to go away completely, like going to England or going to Kashmir, beyond your formal allotted amount.
Was leave a right?
It's always tradition, and it's still so in the British Army, that it's only a privilege. So you can be denied your leave and you have no recourse at all.
How did you use your own leaves?
I went to Kashmir, and the first time I got some leave when I was at Merit, that was to go and join my brother who was up there. I hadn't seen him for some years, so I had leave up in Kashmir. And then from the Northwest Frontier, I saved up some leaves there and went up up to Kashmir again. And then the third lot of leave I got, I managed to get 3 months by taking some extra leave, and then came home to England. But I was cut short after 2 months because of the approach of war, and so I only got in 2 months in England.
Was pressure put on you to spend your leave in a particular way, or not to spend your leave in a particular way?
I think there was pressure to use your leave to go and do something, not just to do nothing. And one can be critical of the fact where you were not encouraged just to go along and spend it in Delhi, as I said earlier on. I think the general attitude of the army was probably quite right. You should go off and do something definite, and then shooting was a good thing. It taught you many of the qualities that you needed to be a good soldier. And Kashmir, after all, was going to see a completely new part of the country, a different part of the country, and there was a lot to do when you got there. There was lovely fishing, the superb shooting. I started to trek up into Tibet and got up into the mountains there on the borders, and then was recalled at this false alarm in 1938 of war. There was so much to do up there that apart from socialising, you did have a tremendous amount that you could do up there in the way of sport and activities.
Coming back to the work or the training which you did in India, do you think that the training which you received for the tasks which were peculiar to India, such as training for frontier warfare or for being called out in aid of the civil power, do you think that training for those tasks which were specifically peculiar to India limited your effectiveness as a soldier when it came to the Second World War and you had to face up to major world powers such as Japan and Germany?
It should have done, but it didn't somehow. You gained a professionalism, I think. You'd actually heard shots fired, you'd actually fought and people had died. It gave you immense self-confidence to adapt yourself, I think, the fact that you'd seen action. The training we'd had apart from the Northwest Frontier of India was very hard. It taught you to be hard on the job, and there was a very much a professional outlook about everything you did. And so when you came back to England or European warfare, I think you really applied this professionalism, and after that the techniques are something that really, I won't say a minor, but this attitude is the basic thing, and then after that you apply your techniques. As a matter of pure interest, I was one of the lucky six brought back after the war had broken out, six from each regiment, so that we could help to level out the professional soldiers across all the armies. And one of my first jobs when I got back was to run a course, 6 week course, for retired army officers to bring them up to date. And as only a lieutenant, two pips on my shoulder, I was having these retired officers up to captain level brought back, some of them from World War I, including the present Duchess of Kent's father, and put them through a 6 week intensive course. And I certainly didn't feel old-fashioned then. I was putting over all the basic things that were still to be taught in modern war as it was at that time, and one taught them all the sort of elements of map reading and night patrol work and everything, which had remained the same really in the last war.
Whilst you were a soldier in India, did you have any joint training exercises with the RAF?
No, one saw nothing of that at all. We did training with the cavalry a lot in Meerut because it was predominantly a cavalry station, the Northwest Front of India. We didn't really have to train them so much as we had to learn how to signal for them, where to come down and drop messages or to pick up messages. It's an elementary form of picking up messages off a wire between two poles and this sort of thing. And how to put out your panels. We had panels. Wherever you went on the top of a picket, you put out your cross panels or your T-shaped panels to show where the enemy were and to show whether you were in contact with them or not. So you learnt all this communication by the use of panels. And that's probably all that was necessary, really. The aeroplanes at that time were Whoppertys. That's going way back into history. Very few people now would even know a Whopperty at all.
You mentioned earlier about something about the relationship between the British soldier in India and the servants around the barracks. What was the relationship like between the British soldier and the sepoy?
One didn't get much of that down in the plains. One came across it in the Northwest Frontier more. I think the British soldier didn't have enough contact with his opposite numbers in the plains. But on the Northwest Frontier of India, of course, we were competing on equal terms completely. And although predominantly at first, in the first campaign, we were with Gurkhas, the second campaign, based on Rusmuk, there was a mixture of many kinds of Indian Army regiments there. And finally gained a great respect for one another. I think the Indian sepoy in the very good regiments, they wondered whether the British were any good, particularly when it came to things like mountain warfare. And I think in the case of some regiments like mine, they learned to respect us very much. In return, I think our chaps saw that these Indian soldiers were very fine chaps indeed. And although there'd been so much respect for the Gurkha before, there were these peculiar conditions whereby the Gurkha was treated as a mercenary troop and therefore as an equal who could use the Nafis. Indian troops were not allowed into British Nafi, for example. And so automatically the British troop had always been taught that Johnny Gurkha was a very good chap and his equal. He'd never had this knocked into him as far as the Indian side was concerned. And then when he saw the Indian troops, again, everything so much depends on regiments. They vary as much as they do in the British Army. But they saw the good Indian Army regiments behave extraordinarily well. Then they gained a great respect for them indeed.
Did any instances of conflict or rivalry occur between the British soldier and the Indian soldier, to your knowledge?
No. I don't think I can remember. I can't remember any cases where there's sort of drunken fighting or anything else going on. But then, of course, there was this bit of segregation whereby the British Nafi was out of bounds to the Indian soldier and vice versa. I don't know what form of Nafi the Indian soldiers had, but our British Nafis were run by the contractor, who contracted with the regiment. And to this, I said, only the British troops were allowed in. And the Gurkhas could go in, although I don't remember the Gurkhas particularly taking advantage of this.
As a junior officer in India, what did you think about the general quality of the leadership from the senior officers with whom you're in contact there?
This, of course, mostly has to be confined to my own regiment, although we swapped experiences with other young officers. It varied a lot by regiments. I said earlier on there's a great professionalism. I think that's the first thing one's got to realize. One took one's soldiering very seriously and at very high standards. There was a very fierce discipline amongst the officers with themselves. And at the beginning, I mentioned, I thought this was rather a hard upbringing, which may have stood one later in good stead. I think there was also disadvantages in that system, which I didn't like, that if you have fairly tough discipline applied without discretion, then you are not bringing out the better qualities in each person. I certainly think in my case, I had certain resentments when I had spoken to them in different ways at different times. I thought most unreasonably. It may have done me good to a certain degree, but I didn't think it brought out my best qualities. And this lack of appreciation of how to bring out the best in a person, I think, was a fault in the leadership training at that stage, at that time. There were a large number of, comparatively large number of bachelor senior officers knocking around, which is astonishing nowadays. It happened then. And they developed idiosyncrasies, as I think any bachelor does do. There've been people who've been abroad for years and years, that inclined to make them eccentric also. So you've got very definite personalities amongst the senior officers. And they did what they thought was right, and they weren't going to be bothered in studying you to see how to lead you. This is the criticism I make of the system. And one has to balance this rather cold-hearted approach to life against the fact that you voluntarily went into the army, you knew what you had to face, and you bought it, and you were given a rough time. All one could learn was lessons from it, and when one's own time came to command, I think, to learn lessons from it, and this attitude of sheer cold harshness with people, or hardness rather, I hope I didn't pass on, although I hope I retained the sort of professional standards and professionalism that you wanted to have. But the sort of way you could get trained, I remember certain incidents that stick in my mind even now. When I was orderly officer, I had to go and be called out for a fire drill, and I supervised the men with a funny old machine that went psh, psh, they'd pump it up and down each side. And along came a senior officer on his horse, seeing that everything was going all right, and blasted me with a lot of swear words as to why the hell I was standing there supervising the men. I should be leading them helping them myself. So I thought, well, all right, I did it. The next time I was orderly officer, the fire drill happened again. I don't think it was a coincidence. The same senior officer came along the horse. And there I was pumping away with the men, and I got called over. Mr. Pryke, what the bloody hell do you think you're doing? Your job is to supervise things and not to do something the soldier could do. You're supposed to be looking after them, telling them what to do. So whatever you did was wrong. This is part of the training of a young officer. I can't believe this is the best way to bring up a young officer. There are ways of taking it out of you which might be more constructive than that. That was the harsher side, but I do have to emphasize to balance that. I think one... But to balance that, one has to put on the credit side that this training tested you. You were going through a trial testing period, and if you survived, you were a very professional person who passed on a certain harshness, maybe, to your men as well, and this went right the way down the line, and everyone was on their toes considerably. I think it went with the spirit of the time. It certainly would not be a good thing to do nowadays, but it went with, I think, the general attitude of people at that time.
What was the attitude of the British soldier or British officer towards the Anglo-Indian community in India?
They were mainly confined, of course, to railways and canals, and I think they had an unfortunate time because they were definitely looked down on by the British, and the Indians, I think, didn't like them either, so they were caught in between two fires, and they kept very much a separate community on their own. One saw very little of them, although us young subalterns used to get invited to go down to their club evening parties on Saturday night, and sometimes one went down there and spent a lively evening. But this was officially frowned on, and one didn't go around telling everybody, but it was a thing that you didn't sort of go around saying that you'd done it, but you just did it, and we find it great fun as young officers.
Was the idea to try to get you married off to the younger Indian girls?
Well, the girls were quite often attractive, and certainly I think there was this feeling that they would like to, because many of them wished to escape from the predicament they were in, because there was no future for them. And I think this would have been the case. I don't know of any cases where this happened. I've heard of cases. I certainly came across it to some degree in Kashmir, where some of the better off one families, they sent wives and if they had daughters up to Srinagar and Kashmir, and I think hoped to try and mix with the British community up there, and I actually saw this happen.
You said something earlier on about your attitude as officers towards the Indian civil service at the time, your admiration for their work. What about other European civilians in India? Did you come across them much, and what was your attitude towards them?
Yeah, the other people one really came across were the police, I think, as a young officer, and the different services army remand services, people on the still in the service of some sort. One did not come across businessmen. You were not normally in areas where the British business was, which was mainly based on Bombay and Calcutta. I don't remember meeting any business people in Ferozepur. There must have been many in Lahore, and one came across them occasionally, say at Polo, or at the point-to-points. They had point-to-points at Lahore. But there were not many of them, and one really didn't come across them very much. And so, really, you had nothing, no experiences, unless you met them passing through Bombay on your way to and from England.
Did you find that the attitudes of the policemen you said you came across were different in any way from those of the British officers, their attitudes towards India and Indians?
I think they probably were very different indeed. They knew India intimately, and they, when they went out there for life, like the Indian Civil Service, like the Indian Army. And therefore, their attitude was bound to be much more... well, they knew India so much better than we did, who only went out for a very short time indeed. And I don't know whether it's more sympathetic or not. It's awfully difficult to... It's a subjective phrase. I think they knew India so well. They knew India with all its faults and all its qualities. And perhaps like the Indian Army officer, they got to love it. And I don't think you'll find any Indian Army officer who didn't really enjoy, when he looks back, every moment he had in India. And I imagine that the Indian Civil Police officer must have felt very similar, and so also the Indian Civil Service.
Did you ever come across missionaries in India?
Yes. White fathers. A certain admiration for them. They seemed to come out there for so many years, it was quite impossible. They were out and about in the heat and everything else. I'd say great admiration for them, although we personally only met them occasionally.
Did you ever feel that the work of Christian missionaries in India was a threat in any way to the British position in India?
No, it never occurred to us at all. I don't think any of us felt this. I don't remember ever feeling like that at all. As I said, the little one that came in contact with these fathers, one had great admiration for them. Whatever work they were doing, it must have been magnificent, because they must have been alleviating suffering in some way or other, or helping to educate, and either of those things appeared so obviously necessary that anything you could do to help India would have been good.